Welcome back. A Northern Virginia woman with hair over 6 feet long cut and donated it Thursday morning. And while she's at it, she set a new Guinness World Record. Zahab Kamal Khan last cut her hair when she was 13 years old. Now she's 30. She credits her grandmother's oil for helping keep her hair healthy. She applies it twice a week. Khan set the record for a new category, most hair donated to a charity by an individual. She and her dad have dreamed of this day since she was a young girl. She's decided to donate her hair to children with hair loss. You can read more in the news section at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, more of my conversation with Sarah Whalen as we discuss the assassination of Princess Diana right here on Coast to Coast AM. So Sarah, back maybe 1,000 years ago, during the time of William the Conqueror or King Henry VIII, there was a lot of superstition. So perhaps you can understand why they thought that sacrificing a royal or someone in their stead, might ensure a good crop or fertility or good fortune for the subjects. But in 1997, what purpose would it serve to sacrifice someone like Princess Diana? Obviously there were some threats that she posed, but did they still honestly believe that sacrificing her had another purpose?
Well, again, when you use the word royals, I mean, there are a lot of royals. There are hundreds of them. But of course, the royal families become smaller and smaller. But yes, I do believe there's a core inner circle, and they work with this tradition. I think it's a big part of their identity. And of course, it's not much talked about, but if you look at the people close to the royals, there are a lot of very unusual deaths in that group. Can't be easily explained.
And Barry Manicky.
Manicky, yes. He was Princess Diana's personal protection officer, they call him PPOs, a bodyguard. And of course, he was a police officer. And he was married with two children. And apparently, they fell deeply in love. And, she was always very oblique when she talked about it, but she did talk about it. And I think nowadays people don't have any doubt that she had an affair with Manicky. And he was killed in a very weird, unusual automobile accident. He was riding pinion. He was a passenger on a motorbike. And apparently a young girl struck him with her car, Nicola Chop. And she was blamed for the accident. But Chop said that she didn't see Manicky because her vision was blocked by what she called an estate car, a large, heavy car, which then suddenly pulled away. And apparently, she struck the motorbike, and Manicky was killed instantly. And Princess Diana, I think, was, of course, extremely distraught, even though their affair had ended. If you look at photographs of Sarah Ferguson's wedding to Prince Andrew, look very carefully at Princess Diana. She's wearing a teal dress with dark polka dots and a hat. And she's smiling, but I think personally behind that smile is a lot of terror. Supposedly that was the morning that she was caught in flagrante delicto, in an embrace or maybe even in bed with Manicky in some position that was inappropriate, and Manicky got fired. And, this very unusual death afterwards.
Right.
But in those
another one
where she's caught, I think she knows something dreadful is going to happen. And if you look at when they went to Cannes a few years later, which is supposedly the day that Prince Charles told her that Manicky had died in this awful motorcycle accident with a car, she wrote about it and she talked about it. She left a series of videotapes of herself. And, you know, some things she told to her, I should say, her co-writer of her true story, Andrew Morton. But other things she told to Peter Sutherland, who, you know, was a massage therapist who became a confidant and then made a series of videotapes about her that where she spoke directly into the camera. And she talked about her lovers. And it was, it's pretty hair-raising stuff. So it's all out there. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Right.
Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say that, and there were others close to the inner circle that died mysteriously. Hugh Lindsay, a former equerry, right. Prince Gerald's goddaughter, Tara Palmer Tompkinson, found dead in her apartment, mysterious right. circumstances.
Right. And also James Gilby, who Diana, that's the man who's talking to Diana on the Squidgy Gate tape, where he says, Squidgy, Squidgy, I love it, love it. And they have this very romantic, flirty conversation. And I think at one point he even talks about masturbating. I mean, he doesn't use the word masturbation. It's pretty clear, you know, that it was a sexual phone call. And he had a fiance who was found dead in her apartment. And she had started to talk. She'd started to go to the papers and give interviews. And she was also an aristocrat. And, you know, these people, they have drug problems. Tara Palmer Tompkinson had drug problems. And I think, actually, if you look at the modern British royal family, you'll find drug use is probably pretty high. I don't think Prince Charles uses it, but certainly other lesser members of the royal family, I wouldn't be at all surprised. And they've alluded to, I think Princess Michael of Kent's son has alluded to drug use by him and other people at his level of royalty. And so, you know, if you're a drug user, it's easy to kill you.
You
have an overdose, and then it looks like you accidentally did something to yourself. And these things are very seldom questioned, but the deaths around the royals at very particular times, it raises questions and it shows a pattern. But the whole Hugh Lindsay thing, that's just a very strange story. He was a great guy. And again, you know, he came from a very English royal background. And he was a military officer. And he was close to the royals. He became a member of this inner circle of courtiers and assistants who helped them. And it's reported that he had an affair with Princess Anne, who also had an affair with a bodyguard. I mean, if you want to be really, the scandal about Princess Anne has always been that she had an affair with one of her PPOs. And even had a child with him. They say that Princess Zara is actually the daughter of Anne and her PPO. But Princess Anne is of royal blood. So there's a difference in the royal family. People who are princes and princesses of royal blood, they get a lot of passes. The people who, like Princess Diana, they obtain their royal title by marriage, don't get.
Right.
The ones
right.
who are married, who are the most expendable. And but anyway, Hugh Lindsay, he'd had an affair with Princess Anne. And I think that the Queen actually expected Hugh to propose marriage to Anne. And was very surprised when Hugh then fell in love with a woman named Sarah, who was a secretary at Buckingham Palace. And he and Sarah married. And, you know, the royals, they just kind of roll on these things. Nobody gets really openly reactive. And I think he felt very comfortable, although they separated him from royal service because there's supposedly a rule, only if there's a married couple, only one can be in royal service at a time. So Sarah remained at Buckingham Palace, and she was pregnant. And he once he was invited to go skiing with Charles and Diana in a larger group in Kloster, Switzerland. And supposedly Prince Charles took his party off, what they call off-piste. In other words, they weren't skiing on a groomed slope. They were going to ungroomed areas. And there was an avalanche, and Hugh Lindsay was killed. Prince Charles was protected and told to jump by, there's a Bruno, I'm going to get his name wrong, it's a German name, Spreckler, I think, who was a ski professional who was with them. But Hugh was killed, and his body was brought back. And, I mean, the eeriest thing about the whole deal, Princess Diana, of course, is there, and the whole reception of the body at the Air Force base, and it was like almost like Princess Diana was able to watch how her body would be flown back from Paris and received with a royal guard with a flag draped over her coffin. I mean, that all happened for Hugh, and she was there watching it. If you look at the photograph of Hugh Lindsay's, you don't really see the funeral, but you see the reception of the body from the plane. And, you know, they want the report said that Charles just wanted to stay and go skiing again. And kind of oblivious to this event.
Right.
And I just was apparently shamed into coming back by Princess Diana. But these people who are very close to the royals, they have unusual accidents that seem to fit in pretty well with the 7-year cycle.
Interesting. All right, so let's,
if it's still going on.
Let's speed ahead to August 31st, 1997, in Paris. And Princess Diana and her friend Dodi Fayed at the Ritz-Carlton in Paris. The evidence that this was orchestrated, let's start with the Mercedes, the vehicle that they had been driving around in one Mercedes all day. And then at the last minute, that car is swapped out for another one.
Right.
Why was that?
There's been a lot written about the cars. I would just like to say at the outset, Dodi was way more than Diana's friend. I think there's very little doubt they were going to get married. It was a whirlwind kind of courtship, and yet another reason to do something quickly, because with the Al-Fayed money behind her, I do believe that Diana would have been unstoppable, and she would have had enormous power to harm Charles, and his whole ability to one day take the throne would have been severely compromised. But yes, the Mercedes, it was switched out. And they were given one that had untinted windows, which is unusual. And there was a big investigation done into the company that did that. The fact that they weren't wearing seatbelts at the time of the crash, that was a very major factor. In fact, had Diana been wearing a seatbelt, she very likely would be alive today. It was a bad impact crash, but survivable if you're wearing a belt. And in fact, the one person who did survive in the front, there's been debate as to whether the bodyguard's belt was working or not, but he was in the front passenger seat. And just about the worst thing that happened, he went through the windshield and, you know, he did horribly damage his face, but otherwise he was alive. Whereas the driver next to him died immediately. I mean, he was just both on the left side, both the driver, Henri Paul, and Dodi Al-Fayed, who was sitting behind Henri Paul on the left passenger side. Their aortas were severed, their spines were broken. They died within a few minutes. I believe Henri Paul died instantly. And that was another issue, because later they said when they did the tests on the blood, there was a lot of carbon monoxide. They said, well, maybe he inhaled it when his face went into the airbag, which was a fact. And but they found out that he didn't take a breath. That he would have been dead before he went through the airbag.
Right. So how else to explain the carbon monoxide in his blood, except that perhaps the sample was switched?
Yeah. So the blood sample was either switched or contaminated. And I think that Mohammed Al-Fayed's team, they did a very good job on determining that blood sample, because there had been, I think, a suicidal man who'd come in earlier. The body had come in, and he had a high level of carbon monoxide because that's how he had killed himself. Plus, he had consumed a lot of alcohol. And so to this day, Henri Paul's parents, of course, they believe that the sample was either switched or contaminated, and the blood examined was not Henri Paul's blood. But anyway, getting back to the fact that the seatbelts, they weren't wearing belts. For Diana, it's fairly unusual. And then you have the question, were the seatbelts working in the car? Because, you know, it might be typical for a passenger, a woman who's wearing, you know, a very lovely gown or something with very complicated jewelry. Maybe she doesn't want to put a belt on and she feels safe in the car. But for nobody to be wearing a belt is very unusual.
And so that's why they switched the car, because they had to switch it with one where the seatbelts weren't functioning.
Right. There's been a lot of debate on the seatbelt. Right.
The route that they took back to Dodi Fayed's apartment is kind of strange, and because they would have had a clear shot had they simply taken the Champs-Élysées, and yet they decided to go through the Alma Tunnel, where the security cameras coincidentally were not working.
Right. There's also a slip road. It's called the Georges Sank, and chauffeurs are more likely to take that if they have VIP passengers because there are fewer lights. One reason to avoid the Champs-Élysées is that it's a straight shot, but it has a number of stops. And so the idea was that maybe the car could get swarmed with paparazzi. There's less of a chance of that if you take the Georges Sank. But both routes are very direct back to Dodi's apartment. And according to eyewitnesses on the scene, both before the accident, there were several eyewitnesses who said that the exit ramp that would have taken them either to the Champs or to the Georges Sank, that those ramps were blocked by vehicles, so you couldn't exit them. In other words, somebody parked their car there. I think in one case there was a motorbike. So Henri Paul couldn't take those exits. What he probably thought, I mean, it's a theory, is that if he took the Alma Tunnel and then he could just make a right and go back up the Seine, and there's another bridge and you could cross and be back on the side of Paris where Dodi's apartment was. And that was probably what he intended to do. But they had to, if they wanted to create the accident, they had to force Henri Paul to drive into the tunnel. And I believe that's what happened. And eyewitness testimony confirms that.
Right. And again, the closed circuit TV cameras that
none
ran 24/7, none of them working. Where have we heard that before, Sarah?
Lots of places. I mean, you know, they turn the cameras off when they don't want you to see. And not only were the cameras not working, which is unusual, but then immediately after the accident, the French, when I always say police, I don't mean the average policeman on the street, French security and the government started to blame the paparazzi, claiming they had caused the accident.
Not only did Sarah, I've got to take a quick time out. Pardon the interruption. We'll pick up on the other side. Sarah Whalen is the author of Royal Vengeance. Back with more of our conversation in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And we'll get back to our conversation with Sarah Whalen, author of Royal Vengeance, The Assassination of Princess Diana and the Ancient Royal Cult of Human Sacrifice. And we'll talk about why this orchestrated car crash had all of the hallmarks of an MI6 operation. In fact, we would learn later from Richard Tomlinson, a former MI6 operative turned whistleblower, that this exact same operation and method was being planned to take out former Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic by MI6. All right, phone calls for Sarah Whalen when Coast to Coast AM returns. Stay with us. Sarah, I mentioned Richard Tomlinson, the former MI6 operative, who said that the operation to take out Princess Diana mirrored almost exactly the plan to take out former Serbian president Slobodan Milosevic. Just if you could quickly walk us through how this operation went down.
Right. Well, that was one of the sensational things that came out in the inquest. And of course, the British government tried really hard to censor Richard Tomlinson. They basically hounded him out of the country and then hounded him around the world. Later, they apologized for it. And, you know, so now he can actually return to England if he wants. But he was an MI6 officer himself, and he stated that he had seen this plan, and part of the plan was there was a meeting in Geneva, which has, it's a mountainous area of Switzerland, and it has lots of tunnels. So the idea was to cause a fatal traffic crash inside the tunnel and wreck the car that Milosevic would be traveling in and kill him. And the way this was going to be achieved was to blind the driver of Milosevic's car with a bright flash. And by flash, I don't mean what you see with a photographer's camera. I mean, it's a military strobe light. It's laser-driven. They've been used for years in combat. And in fact, there's a Geneva Protocol. It's Protocol 4, which is about the use of strobe lights in battle as a form of weaponry. And apparently, if the light is too bright, it can harm your retina. It can permanently blind you. And I think that some Swiss physicians were concerned with veterans that, you know, in addition to all the other things that veterans suffer in combat, some would now be permanently blinded or else very visually disabled. And then that condition would be permanent. So they began to put limits on the use of the laser light and strobe in combat. But it's a well-known thing. And now you can buy them as a self-defense mechanism. You can flash it at an attacker, and it will blind him. So the idea was that when Henri Paul pulled into the Alma Tunnel, not being able to exit the normal way, he was immediately hampered by a white Fiat Uno that caused the car to change lanes and slow down. And there was an impact between the Fiat Uno and the Mercedes. And the impact, there were two of them. The rear light of the Fiat was broken, and there was glass that was shattered. You know, it was on the ground, on the road. And there was a white paint smear, and forensics analyzed the paint. They found it belonged to a white Fiat Uno, you know, within a certain period of time. But Richard Tomlinson recognized the facts of what happened in the tunnel with Diana, and he contacted Mohammed Al-Fayed and gave him the theory of the case, and that MI6 had this plan. And if they were going to use it on Milosevic, they could use it on anyone they wanted to kill
right.
in a car crash.
And witnesses saw this blinding light. They saw this strobe go off.
Many witnesses, there are more than five, who were in various places, in the tunnel, outside the tunnel. It was so bright, it looked like lightning. It wasn't a regular, normal flash bulb. And
so they hit...
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
They hit the 13th pillar. Is that a coincidence or is that significant?
Well, you have to ask yourself. I mean, obviously the number 13 would have significance to people who are trying to achieve something, you know, in the occult. And I hate to say this, I hate to make the analogy, but just look at modern films, you know, where you see these dramatic car crashes. even just to achieve the car crash in a movie, they're very heavily orchestrated, but they're orchestrated by people who know what they're doing. And a lot of the car crashes are not faked. I mean, they crash cars. This is what they do. You know, at a certain speed, a certain momentum, what's going to happen? I mean, if you believe in the occult, and you believe in these supernatural powers, then, you know, yes, 13 would have an enormous significance. And if there is a blood cult behind it, you know, if it is a pagan cult, 13 just is, of course, we consider it an unlucky number. But I think they probably would have been happy with a crash anywhere, but that particular pillar, yeah. And if you drive by, you'll see that the marks are still there of
right.
Where she died.
So she suffers a pulmonary tear, which is
right.
It's bad, but it's very survivable. Had she been transported quickly to hospital, and there was a hospital close by. But then they proceeded to wait an hour and a half before they took her out of the vehicle, and then another half hour, I guess, to get her to the hospital. At some point, the hospital,
after she'd been taken out, it was like an hour and 45 minutes. But here's the rule: it's called the golden hour, and even that's somewhat dated. If you from the 1960s, a physician observed automobile accidents and trauma victims. And he determined that if you could get that person to a hospital within 60 minutes, their chances of surviving their injury went up tenfold. And the longer you delayed, the more fatalities rose. Now they have, I think, what they call the platinum 10 minutes, which is to get somebody out of the vehicle to assess them. When someone's in the vehicle in a crash, you can't properly assess them. The danger would be injury to the spine. And I think John Morgan, he's dead now, but he was a great forensics researcher in New Zealand. And he wrote a whole series of books on what he believed was the Princess Diana murder conspiracy. They're very, very detailed. And I go into some more detail in my book on the medical side, because they could have easily gotten her out of the car in 10 minutes. And even if they took her to the hospital they sent her to, PTA Salpêtrière, you know, she could have been saved. She was dead by the time she got there. She had the pulmonary vein. It was a small tear, and it's survivable, but the tear has to be stitched. Basically, she just bled into her chest. And it's not an unexpected injury, given that the two other people, Henri Paul and Dodi Al-Fayed, are dead from deceleration injuries. So you have to assume that the other people in the car may have the same thing. Now, the bodyguard, Trevor Rhys-Jones, who was screaming, couldn't really talk because his jaw was broken. But he'd gone through the windshield, but he was fine. He's what they call the distracting passenger. That's a person who may distract an emergency worker. But in the French case, they had actual doctors there. I mean, Jean-Marc Martino, who handled Princess Diana, he's technically a doctor. He hadn't, apparently he was like a month away from his official license. So he should never have been in the ambulance anyway. But he was the one who held her there for an hour and 45 minutes. And
what do you think he was paid off?
I do. I mean, I think it's very, you would have to look. If you want to really have an investigation, you would have to do more than simply ask Dr. Martinez some questions. I mean, imagine in the United States, if you were going to look into that, you would be looking at bank accounts, you'd be looking into fund transfers. I mean, that might not even tell you, because now it's Bitcoin, and yeah, there are a lot of ways to pay people off. But
all right, let me grab a quick call here, if I could.
Sure.
Let me grab a call here, Sarah. Let's say hi to John in San Diego. John, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Hi, Sarah.
John.
Hi, Richard. Thanks. say I laid out this whole thing a long time ago when it happened. Here's how they did it. They had MI6 posing as paparazzi. They had a person slip the driver a Mickey in his drink to get him off balance.
Well, you know, I agree with the first part. The number of paparazzi, there have always been questions about that. And certainly, you know, if an MI6 agent or even just some criminal wrongdoer wanted to do something, the easiest way would be to pretend to be a paparazzi. The witnesses saw a motorbike come through. I mean, the motorbike that actually caused the accident had a person driving the motorbike, an opinion passenger. They think that's the passenger is the one who flashed Henri Paul. There is a video, the closed circuit TV at the Ritz was working, and I've seen it many times, and you can go online and look at it. Henri Paul does not appear to be at all drunk. I mean, he leans down and ties his shoe. A drunk person can't do that. I mean, you know, not without falling or looking wobbly. And at no point did Henri Paul look at all drunk. But I do think that the flash, whether he'd had a drink or not, the flash would have been enough to completely disable him.
Right. And Trevor Rees-Jones was charged with protecting Princess Diana. If he knew that Henri Paul was fall down drunk, there's no way he would have allowed her to get in that car.
Right. And Trevor Rees was very adamant about that himself. He claims to have no memory of the accident, but he said, I'm a professional. I never would have allowed anyone to get in the car with Henri Paul, certainly not Princess Diana. And, you know, there was a question about how much Henri Paul had to drink. I can tell you this, having lived and worked in France, they drink more than the average people generally. And a lot of them are driving around. And I don't know if there are crashes or any greater or less, but there were all kinds of rumors. The driver was drunk. He was speeding. We now know he was speeding a little bit, but it was like 60, 65 miles an hour. I mean, under normal circumstances, this is nothing. And there was even an expert witness who testified at the inquest. I think it was Tom Treasure, pretty sure. But he said that basically, you know, people do tend to drive a bit drunk, but most times it does not end up in a crash, and it does not appear to have caused the crash.
All right, let's grab another call here. Barbara is in Lakeland, Florida. Barbara, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just have a real quick question, Sarah. Do you have any information, did you run across any information that would lead you to believe that Harry might not have actually been the son of Prince Charles? And I'll take
I'm sorry.
For you. Thank you.
That Harry wasn't the son of Prince Charles, perhaps. Well, maybe he was the son of Barry Manicky.
Yes. You know, by this time, look at the genetics. I mean, most people think he's the son of James Hewitt because of the red hair and the coloring. But what you really, and then, you know, Diana's butler came in to try to save her reputation, saying, oh, all the Spencers have red hair. You know, this is just red hair from the Spencers. And Diana herself made a point of calling Harry her little Spencer. But the fact is, to make a redheaded child, you need two people to carry that gene. It's a recessive gene. And you don't see a lot of redheads in the British royal family. So it's possible, you know, that Prince Harry could be the child of one of Diana's lovers. Could be Manicky, who she seemed to love very much, and that would have been at the height of their affair. When Prince Harry was born.
Right.
So, you know, and I will say that if you look at photographs, there are not a lot of official photographs, but people have, you know, there's things on the internet, the photographs where you can pin them. And people have collected enormous troves of photographs of Diana with Manicky. And a lot of times he's not directly in the picture, but very often you see him walking hand in hand hand with Prince William. And you never see a photograph of Prince Charles, you know, being such a hands-on person. And, of course, Manicky had two children of his own, and he was a real father. And I think he related to Prince William that way. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to learn that Manicky is actually the biological father of Prince Harry. And, of course, I don't have any proof of this. I'm just surmising.
Right. Another motive is that if Princess Diana had lived, Charles never would have been allowed to remarry and then not become king, right?
Yeah, well, yes and no. At the time of her death, the rule was that the King of England could not be divorced. Whoever the ruling monarch was, it could not be divorced. And in the days of Queen Elizabeth, I should say in the days of her mother, divorced people, it was regarded as an illness that you might catch. So divorced people weren't even allowed in the presence of the monarch. You couldn't be received at court. And this only broke down late in the reign of Queen Elizabeth, when, of course, her sister Margaret had a very unhappy marriage. And by that time, you know, divorce became possible. But Princess Anne was allowed to get a divorce. But by that time, she was very far down in the succession. So nobody was worried about the issue coming up. But divorce for the Church of England, of which Charles would be head when he becomes king, at the time, they did not allow remarriage of divorced people if the spouse was still living. And so Diana
there you go.
Was still living. The way
there's another motive.
Problem, right.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure
exactly.
She's not living anymore. Now,
all right.
I've talked with Anglican clergy, and they have told me, and this is in England, and they have said, well, you know, there were a lot of debates on changing that rule to help Charles. But, you know, the church moves very slowly.
Indeed.
And it just would have churned up more publicity, I'm sure. So,
all right.
Yeah, the time she died, that was the rule. Charles could not remarry.
Sarah,
not
we're out of time.
Phase.
We're out of time, sadly, but I want to thank you for hanging out the last 2 hours. This was a fascinating tale. Appreciate your time. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyon, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galanti, Donna Walker, Chris Burrows, and Sean Latisor, I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until next time, so long for now.